If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family's schedule onto a sleek digital display, so you focus on important things, like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/talk.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, and welcome back to another Behind the Knife. I hope you guys have enjoyed this fantastic trauma series. And we just wanted to give one more shout out to the RAS Behind the Knife collaboration on this Journal Club landmark papers that we have on our YouTube channel. This is a really unique collaboration that will allow you to get a video publication that will be part of RAS and Behind the Knife. And if you guys want to get involved, this is something that we're recruiting. So if there's a specialty that you're interested in and you want to review some of the landmark papers and put some of these videos together, we can help provide you with the resources to do that and teach you how to do it and get you involved and get these published. So Megan, what's the best way for these residents to get in touch to help out with these videos?
Yeah, Kevin. So we really would love to have anyone who wants to participate join in. So first thing is just make sure that you're a resident member of the American College of Surgeons. And then if you are, contact us at btkpodcast@gmail.com, or you can email rasnews@facs.org. Either one is fine, and they will put you in touch with me, and we'll add you to our committee, and you can go forth and make the videos. So reach out to us, email us. You can also contact us on Twitter or our Facebook if that is your preferred avenue.
Yeah, and there's so many great landmark papers that we need to get going. I know one major deficit we have currently is we have no oncology papers. So if you're interested in surgical oncology, this is a great opportunity to help us out and many other fields too. So, well, thank you, Megan, for all your work with this.
Thanks, Kevin.
So welcome back to the Big T Trauma Series on Behind the Knife. In this series, we cover clinically oriented material that focuses on how best to care for traumatically injured and critically ill patients. My name is Patrick Georgioff. I'm a trauma surgery fellow at the University of Texas Memorial Hermann Red Duke Trauma Center in Houston, Texas. And today, I'm happy to be joined by Dr. Brian Cotton and Dr. Ethan Taub. Dr. Cotton is a professor of surgery at McGovern Medical School at the University of Texas in Houston and is the director of the Acute Care and Surgical Critical Care Fellowships here. He is a national leader in the field of trauma resuscitation and is an extremely capable trauma surgeon. Also thrilled to have Dr. Ethan Taub with us today. Dr. Taub is an assistant professor here at the University of Texas as well. He's also the director of the Medical Student Surgery Clerkship here at the University of Texas, and in his own right, not too shabby of a trauma surgeon as well. So it's an honor to have you guys both here today. Dr. Cotton, can you, before we dive into the episode, let's talk real briefly just about your training history, research interests. Maybe tell us a little bit about the Memorial Hermann program here that I've been lucky enough to be a part of.
Sure. Real briefly, trained at the University of Missouri for surgery residency. Went to Penn for fellowship for 2 years, first job at Vanderbilt, where I was completely, radically transformed with what I wanted to do from a research standpoint, from studying delirium, which was my initial area of interest, into doing resuscitation and then later on hemorrhagic shock, based on what I was seeing the practice at the time was and how I wanted to change it. Came to Houston and after about a year took over the fellowship in 2010. We expanded from a surgical critical care one-year fellowship at that time to a two-year fellowship, both in acute care surgery and then later added on a one-year trauma surgery, clinical trauma surgery fellowship. We are a fellowship that has three spots for our two-year program. We have one-year spots as well for the trauma surgery program. Most of those come for non-U.S. trainees that are looking for focused trauma clinical training to take back to their country of origin, although some U.S. trainees, such as yourself, have taken on this trauma fellowship. The program is at the hospital, Memorial Hermann Hospital, and the Red Duke Trauma Institute, busiest trauma center in the U.S. By all numbers that are measured, and has continued to remain quite busy throughout the COVID crisis that we've seen here. It is a fantastic training program, and it is, as I described to many people who have interviewed here, may recognize the title of your program,
The Big T.
The Big T. Are you a Big T or a Big C? And we always encourage people that see themselves or self-identify, if you will, to put it in the current vernacular. If you're a Big T, trauma first, and you do critical care as well, you're a Big T. If you are an intensivist, you're a Big C, and you do trauma on the side or EGS on the side. We look for the people that are interested in being the Big T, the big trauma surgeon. And that's what I think our fellowship offers. We do our own vascular, our own cardiac, thoracic, head and neck stuff, GU trauma, and really try to be the true old school general surgeon for that patient and utilize our consultants accordingly.
Perfect. Could not agree more. Dr. Todd?
I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Cotton in 2013 when I came down to be a fellow after graduating from residency up in on the west side of Chicago at the UIC Mount Sinai program, where I spent 5 years taking care of a lot of penetrating trauma. We had about 50% penetrating trauma volume at my residency, but happily came down here to train at the busiest level one trauma center in the country under the tutelage of Dr. Brian Cotton, who's sitting right here next to me. And it's been a privilege ever since. I left for 1 year after fellowship for a job back in Chicago on the south side, but was recruited to come back to UT about halfway through that year. And it's been quite an honor to be here to follow the footsteps of Dr. Red Duke, who I was fortunate enough to be the last fellow that he ever trained. So it's definitely a busy place, a wonderful place to be a trauma surgeon.
Good. Couldn't agree more. So happy to have you both here today. We're going to do a little something different on this episode, a little different than our prior episodes. And so instead of focusing on one topic, we're going to run through a number of trauma scenarios. And these are some complicated scenarios. But the idea is to get a more nuanced appreciation for some of the more difficult cases that can pop up. And these are scenarios that are somewhat random. They're all related to cases that I was either primary on or involved with here during my training at the Memorial Hermann. And really over about past 4 months is, I think, where we pulled these cases from. So let's go ahead and get started. All right, for the first case, this is a 21-year-old male. Stab wound to the left chest. They present to the trauma bay hypotensive, tachycardic, and tachypneic. Dr. Taub, start with the box. What is the box?
The box really is an anatomic location, anatomic landmarks that make it up, that really define the area where the mediastinum is, where the vital structures are, the heart, esophagus, trachea, etc. And those anatomic landmarks are from the clavicles down between the nipples to the costal margin, anteriorly and posteriorly from the traps in between the scapula down to the scapular tip. Now, those are the classical definitions of the box. But what we've come to realize, a lot of this came out of World War II. But what we know now is bullets don't respect anatomic boundaries and landmarks, and really the box is more of historical significance than it really is of significance for how we take care of these trauma patients. But certainly, that being said, if you have a patient with a penetrating injury within the box, your clinical suspicion should be considerably heightened at that point.
Okay, what structure specifically are you worried about?
I'm worried about any time I see penetrating injury within those landmarks of the box. I'm worried about cardiac injury, injuries to the main bronchus or trachea, injuries to the esophagus, really those mediastinal structures.
Okay, so Dr. Cotton, how do you go about assessing these patients in the trauma bay?
Sure. So I think the first thing you can do, especially if you have a non-intubated patient, I think the way I try to teach the trainees to approach the primary all starts with A, because if you can assess A, the way that I think you should assess it. You can get pretty much A, B, C, and D assessed from ATLS. So if I go up and say, Mr. Johnson, what's your name? Or just, sir, what's your name? And they can, without breathlessness, say, Johnson, I know that their airway's not obstructed. If they can do it not short of breath, their B is probably grossly intact. If they heard what I said and responded, C is probably intact. They got enough perfusion going to their brain to respond. And then D, they've got the neurocognitive response to it. Show me your, you know, wiggle your fingers. Give me a thumbs up. I know this is kind of getting a little outside of the ABCD flow pattern, but honestly, by being able to do that and give me a thumbs up or give me a middle finger or whichever one they choose, they can give me a sense of A, B, C, and D are intact there. But focusing more on this case specifically, that's a good one to start with. But let's say the patient's not responsive. My airway, if it's already established, it's established. If it's not established and not threatened, this is a patient stabbed into the box coming in. I want to assess what the sense of urgency is to actually get them secured and get them protected. Most of these, fortunately, are not going to have to be urgently protected, the ones that are not already.
Now, why are you hesitating to intubate this patient?
Sure. So where they are right now is one of the safest airways they're going to have if they have something going on, even if they're a little short of breath. Putting them under anesthetic, giving them drugs, and losing that airway and getting the potential for cardiovascular collapse with induction is a huge, huge deal. And it's a real thing. I think many of us that have been doing this a while have seen it in a real-time fashion. So this is an airway that if I can absolutely not do it, I would rather take this patient up to the operating room and be inducing and getting that airway established with them prepped and draped and with a knife in my hand and a saw in my trainee's hand.
Right. So you're worried about specific injuries, right? Pericardial tamponade, tension pneumor hemothorax, which need to be rapidly assessed for in the trauma bay, with the ultrasound or chest X-ray. You can also see signs or symptoms of things like tension pneumothorax on exam, hypoxia, tachypnea, hypotension, bulging neck veins. Certainly, if it's severe enough, maybe you feel that shift in trachea, and obviously the absent or distal sounding breath sounds when you actually take a listen. For pericardial tamponade, similar, right? Hypotension, tachycardia, bulging neck veins also could be a distant heart sound. This odd sense of impending doom for patients who are wanting to sit up to breathe, which we should very much allow those patients to do.
Yeah, I was literally getting ready to overtalk you right there.
I caught you.
To say that. No, I was literally, because those are the ones. It's a classic, classic presentation. If that patient wants to sit up and they absolutely are having that pending sense of doom, you need to listen. The patient knows a lot more than you think they know. In fact, that was one of my slides I used to always have when I gave the medical student lectures, of listening to the patient when they are thirsty, when they won't, they can't breathe, they're struggling, I can't swallow. Those are signs that you need to listen to, and this is one of them, when they cannot or will not lay flat.
Perfect. So, Dr. Todd, let's say this patient has a heart rate of 130, blood pressure is 90 over 60. You're in the trauma bay. As part of your workup, you obtain a FAST, and you have pericardial tamponade that's fairly significant on your exam. What do we do next?
At that point, after completing my secondary survey, making sure there's no other injuries anywhere else, I'm going to be taking that patient to the operating room. In the right clinical setting, with a positive FAST of the pericardium, that patient needs a sternotomy or some exploration of their pericardial space in their heart. So depending on the location of the injuries, again, that could be a sternotomy or thoracotomy or clamshell. It really depends on where the injuries are and what else I'm trying to get after. But that patient is going directly to the operating room, not for a pericardial window, not for a diagnostic procedure. The diagnosis is already made in this clinical setting where we have a hypotensive tachycardic patient.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit more, because this is something that's brought up, has been brought up. You say, okay, answer to pericardial tamponade is a window. And it, clearly it's not. But can you elaborate on that a little bit more? There's an injury to the heart, right? There's a hole, presumably from our stab wound,
right?
And doing a window is not going to allow us access, right?
No, a window, a pericardial window, a subxiphoid pericardial window is a diagnostic procedure. That is a procedure to identify the presence of blood within the pericardium in a patient who doesn't have all of the clinical findings consistent with a cardiac injury. So maybe someone who has a proximity injury that you can't get a good look at the heart. Maybe there's a pneumothorax, so the air is precluding the view. Or my other time that I'm doing a pericardial window is in the setting of a left-sided hemothorax with a proximity to a cardiac injury. Then that cardiac injury could be decompressing into the left chest, and in that scenario, I'm also doing a pericardial window to assure that there's no pericardial effusion that's draining into the chest.
Sure. Now, this case, then, to the case you and I did together recently, stab wound to the chest, that ended up being a PA injury, right, and a very large tamponade. And when we went to the operating room, what we did is, exactly as you described, that patient was not intubated. Okay, there were all the things that Dr. Cotton had mentioned we covered. And they were prepped. They had access, products, anesthesia was ready, prepped, draped, saw, confirmed rerunning. The patient was so obtunded due to their worsening clinical scenario that we started our incision before they got anesthesia. And once we were ready to do our sternotomy, that patient was induced, promptly crashed, complete cardiovascular collapse. But at that point, we were in the chest in a matter of, a swipe at the saw, and we're able to assess the injury. So Dr. Cotton, our patient had a PA injury. What if PA versus aorta versus, well, the aorta probably wouldn't make it to us, but a ventricular injury, how do you go about repairing those? How do you control it? What kind of suture pledges, et cetera?
Sure. Let's step back just a second. So let's say you're still in the bay. First of all, I want to go ahead and put a plug in that I think this would be a perfect case to go direct to the OR if your hospital has a policy and a procedure and a system in place. We have this currently in place for air transports. We do not have it in place for ground transports. If this was an air transport, this case that you and Dr. Todd did would have gone straight to the operating theater based on not only physiology, but penetrating and hypotensive penetrating and an ABC score of 2 or more, penetrating positive pericardial fast or an abdominal fast, that would have gone straight to the operating theater from air by our current policy. Ground, we don't have that in place right now.
Right. And I'm just going to add to that, as you mentioned and alluded to, yes, our pre-hospital, our lifelike personnel have the ability to perform fast exams, both pericardial and abdominal fast, in the helicopter on the way. So given those findings, we make that decision to perform an operating room resuscitation.
And also to plug the fantastic group of people that do that run LifeFlight and are members of the LifeFlight team. When we did an evaluation evaluating their ultrasound skills, their ultrasound positive rate was more predictive of going straight to the operating theater than even in the ER. So they are talented in that. Yes, they do miss some, but the ones that they pick up on, they have a pretty good skill set, and they have a good predictive model for going not only mass transfusion, but going straight to the operating theater. So the patient arrives by ground with the same physiology, the same presentation Dr. Jorgoff and Dr. Todd just went over. This patient's pretty much going to get two things that are not a primary. I don't think we're going to get a secondary. We're going to get to E. We're going to do a super fast log roll to make sure there's not other holes going on. And then we're going to get a chest x-ray and a fast. If that fast is positive, you have an answer. If the fast is negative, you don't have an answer. But you don't have an answer. You don't have a positive answer that there's nothing there. Your chest x-ray can be negative, like we talked about. You can have a false negative fast because your x-ray's got a left-sided effusion, sometimes even a right, but more commonly a left.
Can you expand on that a bit? So how do I have a heart injury without tamponade?
Yep.
With some findings in left chest?
Sure. So you've got a stab wound to the box, you have a heart laceration, pericardial injury, and it is decompressing into the left chest, into the pleural space, and that is giving you a negative window on your pericardial exam. Some people are still talented enough, depending on where you are or what night you're on, who's on with you, to pick up on a pericardial effusion that has decompressed. But most of the time, that chest x-ray is going to be your adjunct. And that's why I mentioned getting both together. Unless you're, if you're pericardial fast positive, that's it. You don't need the chest x-ray for that reason. I would still implore it. As long as you had vitals that would allow you to get a rapid chest x-ray, because there still could be a pneumothorax, there could be other things, there could be an impaled object still in the patient. I've seen that before where they've been stabbed and then the knife, the blade part breaks off and the handle is no longer there. And not always does the patient that stabbed them stay around to give that information to the medics and the police before they are transported. So I always try to get x-rays of penetrating wounds so that I can make that determination. If you already haven't alerted your OR that you're coming up hot, that needs to happen almost on arrival. And if you already haven't activated your system's massive transfusion protocol, it needs to be happening now. And that's one to circle back on that one.
That's perfect. A systems-based standpoint that we don't, a lot of the stuff we don't think about as, as opposed to the actual patient, the anatomy, the critically important to managing it. Just an important part of trauma surgery in general is taking a look at the systems-based management. I do want you to answer.
Yeah,
hole in the LV.
Hole in the LV. So if they have the vitals that you've given me, and I can get up to the operating theater, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back up or go up and do exactly what you and Dr. Tom did. The patient's going to get an awake prep and drape. I'm going to physically hear that saw go off. And that reason for that, we talk about the ways we practice medicine when we do rounds, right? The three Fs, fact, fiction, and F-ups, right? And so I've been in that situation where I've reached to grab the saw in an emergency situation, and it wasn't firing. It was not plugged up. The pressure system wasn't working well, and it was not working. So I always want to make sure that saw's it is functional. In addition, you also want to have on your field, just in case something goes wrong, even if it was functioning, a Lebschi or something that you can get through, whatever you're comfortable with, to get through that sternum rapidly if that saw malfunctions. So now I'm in the chest. I've opened, done my sternotomy. I see the LV. It depends on where it's located. But for the most part, this is going to get either a sponge forcep that is allowing the heart to still beat and just dabbing and holding pressure on that very gently, allowing it to beat, not pushing too much down. It's going to bleed around it, but not exsanguinate through that LV. That's what you're looking for. You're going to be doing that while your partner, whoever you're operating with, is getting that pledgeted 2-0 proline up and ready and getting that ready to be loaded. You're going to load back through it. I like to do a horizontal mattress, and I will usually do 4 separate pledgets or 2 separate pledgets, either 4 squares or 2 rectangles, one on each side of the laceration, or 4 for each corner that goes in, and do a horizontal mattress repair of this.
Yep, that's exactly how I would do it as well, whether it's 2-0 or 3-0 or 3-0 proline, but almost always pledgeted and almost always horizontal mattress, which lets you avoid coronary arteries if they're in proximity to the cardiac injury.
I usually prefer, again, 3-0 is fine. It's usually not the 2-0 versus 3-0 for me. It's usually the needle, mm-hmm. because you've got a beating heart,
yeah.
And that also takes into consideration. People need to realize you're throwing this on a beating object, and it is quite mobile, and you've got blood there. So the first few times you do it, it can be a little unnerving. It'd also be unnerving after doing 10 of them. You need to be able to make one single pass, and so we usually want a little bit larger needle, and the 2-0s that we have currently affords that. But again, you just need to figure out what works at your system for everything that we're saying here, because as Bill Schwab used to tell us during fellowship, just like politics, all problems are local, all solutions are local. Right. So figure out what you have at your hospital to pull this off.
Specific needle types, I like an MH needle. That's a nice big needle, and I think folks have a tendency to take a kind of chintzy bite, a small bite of myocardium, and that's the wrong thing to do, especially if your friendly anesthesiologist is behind the curtain and giving some epi because the blood pressure is low, and you take a poor bite of myocardium, they're going to give that epi, the heart is going to fill and beat harder, and the next thing you know, your injury is back open those sutures tear through. So you really have one chance to mention posterior injuries. Use a laparotomy pad to help you lift the heart up, and be careful because fingers will go through myocardium if you're not careful.
Yeah. And when you make, I agree with Dr. Tom, the communication is critical here. Yeah. They need to
for
know.
For all these cases.
For every case. Yeah. For every case. And this is one example of it, where what Dr. Tom brought up, which is about doing the little pushes of norepi and things like that. As soon as you get control, I mean, every little step, you need to let them know what you're doing. Not only when you lift the heart up, and it may very well go into fib, it may very well have an arrhythmia issue. You may lose pulses. They need to know that you're doing it, but you still have to look at the back of the heart. It is absolutely this is your exploratory laparotomy and looking at all the quadrants and running the bowel. This is the equivalent. You absolutely have to get back there and look at the back side of it.
I want to mention, we talk about lifting up the heart. You're talking about lifting up the heart from the apex up to the point up towards the ceiling, right, to look at the back. You will have major outflow issues,
Correct.
And your heart will be unhappy, even the healthiest of hearts. So
correct.
Be prepared for that, but it is critical, as you mentioned, you have to see that.
That's, this is something that requires speed. Probably not something you want to tackle with your most junior resident. If you get a choice, you want a good extra set of hands with you. And another word on flipping the heart over, they will go asystolic, but I remember, I think it was Red Duke used to say, "Well, son, that's your chance to sew." when the heart stops, he starts sewing quickly right then and let the heart down, and it'll start back up again.
Perfect. All right, last question for this case: atrial injury or a venous injury? How do you sew that up? How do you repair? How do you control it?
Atrial injury, especially right atrial appendage, great chance for a side-biting Sitinsky clamp on that. That's going to control and then just do similar like you would on a cava, like a lateral venorophy. Of course, it's not a vein if it's the atrial appendage, but you get the idea. Put that clamp on and close the hole.
Yeah.
Correct. One more plug on the communication. You also need to let them know as soon as you've gotten control so that they don't over-resuscitate. And I can over transfuse. Even the good stuff that I love, with whole blood or plasma and things like that, you still don't want them to blow up that heart. And I've seen them do that several times.
And then one last thing, we're talking about box injuries, transmediastinal injuries. Don't forget the other structures. You need to absolutely look at the trachea or the esophagus if the trajectories are right. Don't forget those other structures. If you've got a stable patient, different from what we're talking about with a transmediastinal wound, if the location's correct, also don't forget about the diaphragms.
And if you've got your intrapericardial IVC or even just above it sometimes, your fingers are your friends. If that side-binding Sitinsky or that little vascular clamp, you cannot make it into the angle through that sternotomy incision, don't be embarrassed to just use your fingers. Don't be shy about that. They're nice and soft, and the finger pads will help kind of compress it enough. Because, again, it doesn't have to be completely hemostatic.
These are extra soft.
Ethan, sorry. This is not an elective case. This is an emergency case. It's okay to have a little bleeding. Just like with the LV or RV injuries we talked about, by just putting a little sponge forceps on it and taking it off in between so you can throw bites, it does not.
Y'all can't see this, but Dr. Cotton's got his hand bouncing around, essentially showing that you're almost riding the movement of the heart back and forth. And again, to that end, you're controlling bleeding, but you're not jamming the whole thing through there, making it bigger.
Correct.
All right. All right, let's get on with the next case. This one, we have a patient comes in with a gunshot wound. Okay, one hole to the left upper chest, just inferior to the clavicle and the more medial aspect of the clavicle. All right, Dr. Cotton, this patient is unstable. They have a legitimately expanding hematoma. They have a pulseless left upper extremity. What's your tips and tricks for management, for approach, for operative approach, et cetera?
Yeah, so this patient is going to go up to the operating theater. You're already going to have your massive transfusion activated. You're going to have your full team ready to go. You're going to have a major vascular set, major chest set ordered and in the room, hopefully, including a saw. You're going to prep and drape both arms abducted, and chin to knees, table to table, bilateral on your prep, just not knowing what you're getting into. You may or may not need other adjuncts that we can talk about later. That's how I'm going to start. The incision here, again, based on habitus and based on what you're presenting, mid versus distal versus proximal clavicle, I would consider, again, an infraclavicular approach on this side versus a supraclavicular approach, depending on what your anatomy is, what your hematoma is. I frequently found the infraclavicular approach to be adequate in a lot of these cases. And in an unstable patient, I would feel more comfortable doing an infraclavicular and planning on doing a claviculectomy or resecting the clavicle in that section if I needed to get...
And let me add, so yeah, let's say, please. So you had a chest x-ray and a pericardial fast negative, right?
Yep.
And I guess since we didn't clarify this far, let's say the bullet stuck up farther in the left, towards the left shoulder.
Correct.
Okay, there's a bullet there. Right?
Correct.
Okay, so this is, we have ruled out badness like we talked about.
Correct.
In our prior
the patient case. Has not died in the ED or lost pulses.
All right, can you expand on where the proximal clavicle, mid-clavicle, distal clavicle, infraclavicular versus supraclavicular excision as you've started talking about. Explain that some more, because that's confusing for a lot of people where the anatomy is.
Right. So to me, all those are referring to the location of that proximal third, middle third, distal third, is helping me decide where I'm going to make my incision because you're looking at proximal and distal control. I got a very proximal third. May very well be needing a sternotomy to get proximal control with an extension into an infraclavicular approach. Right. If you're mid and distal, that's something that you may very well not need a sternotomy or needing to get proximal. You may very well just be able to do an infraclavicular or supraclavicular approach, resect the clavicle or not, again, depending on your anatomy, depending on displacement of the hematoma.
You can just go ahead and resect the clavicle, right?
Absolutely.
If you need to do it, you just do it, right?
Absolutely. And I will tell you, most cases that have survived, that clavicle has been put back in situ and either been resecured with plates or not at that moment. Sometimes it's done in a delayed fashion with ortho. Other times it's just placed back and done by us on the initial case, depending on the patient's status. Mm-hmm. That said, you can also completely just resect it and not put it back. Okay. In general, we try from a functional standpoint to put it back. Even if it's literally just resting there for ortho to fixate later.
One of the course, the ACET course, for this very particular question, the ACET course has a beautiful video and approach, just like for all their approaches, but particularly for this very kind of sphincter tightening situation of a subclavian versus axillary kind of injury, where you're really, this is not something we see that often. It can be, especially if it's an expanding hematoma, you're really worried about your approach. It can be challenging to think about. But the ACET course has a beautiful video and an approach that talks about how you get through the PEC and how and where you identify that subclavian artery. And I would encourage anyone listening who's serious about trauma to take a look at that too, or at least if you haven't done the course, sign up for it, because that's one of the many benefits of the course.
Yeah, I think I think you pretty much covered the exposures. A lot of the textbooks will tell you for a proximal left subclavian that a left posterior lateral thoracotomy is the incision of choice, and I have a really hard time with that in a setting with a patient who's in extremis, yeah, who may have additional unidentified injuries at that point. Flipping a patient on their side anytime emergently, I struggle with that.
I think the time that you would utilize the incision that's in books so often with that incision is going to be more of an anterolateral in the ED because they've crash coded. Yeah. I've used it once for that, I think, and done it. Lost pulse has gone in, saw the very proximal injury, and clamped it proximally via the chest. But there was no way I was going to be able to repair.
Where is it? So left side versus right side. We're talking about left side right now. Where is the what is the trajectory of the proximal subclavian artery? Where does it go? We talk about this a little bit. So superior kind of tracks distally and back farther away. So how do you get to it? Explain in words your best way you can explain what that proximal left subclavian artery is, where it is, and how to get to it.
Yeah, so it's coming off, and Dr. Topp can chime in as well. It's coming off much more posterior than you think. The textbooks will almost give you the impression that they're all three coming off in the single plane. They're really coming off in a curve as that aorta is curving backwards. It's that last branch coming off, and it's going to be a lot more posterior, which again I think was what Dr. Todd was alluding to about how difficult that incision is to get not only just get control of during the patient with extremis, but also to try to repair anything through that incision. But getting control, sweeping that lung down through your thoracic, if you've gone into the chest of that thoracotomy incision, sweeping that.
Before you say that,
yeah,
too,
please.
How would you do your thoracotomy incision if you're in the bay, for instance, or in the OR for that matter? You're gonna do thoracotomy. Is it gonna be higher?
Right. So I try. So almost like when I do my. So when I make a laparotomy incision, I have the trainee make the incision in the midline. And I tell them to cut straight down. Don't deviate. And I grab a towel clip and I retract the umbilicus towards me at the last second and have them continue that incision. When they teach thoracotomy incisions, especially not just thoracotomy but emergency thoracotomy, which is going to be in my wheelhouse, going to be a clamshell if they have lost pulses, if they've died. I try them to almost cut the nipple of the male. If it's a female, to literally grab the breast and retract it upward and cut where the bra line, the underwire, would be cutting in underneath the inframammary fold.
And then in your experience, that incision, the kind of standard RT kind of type recessive thoracotomy incision, is adequate to get access to the proximal left subclavian for control.
If they are dying, it is adequate, but still can be challenging to get proximal control in the bleeding to death patient. It is not, in my experience and in my hands, the incision to be repairing anything through. It is the incision to be getting, oh my God, they're bleeding to death. Now I've clamped the proximal. Now they are no longer bleeding to death, and now I can get up to the operating room and make a more appropriate incision.
Okay.
That reminds me of another tip or caveat to subclavian injuries in patients while you've got them in the bay. Get the biggest Foley catheter you can and put it in that trajectory on your way up to the operating room as your only real means to try and get this to tamponade at least a little bit to hasten blood loss.
Now, Dr. Todd, we talked about left subclavian. What's the difference then in the anatomy of the right subclavian? So
the right subclavian is coming off of the innominate, which is the first branch off of the aortic arch, and that's going to be pretty anterior. It's very anterior, so that's going to be easy access via a median sternotomy.
Yeah.
Another thing I want to mention about the left side, if you do a sternotomy and you can't get to that left subclavian takeoff, make another incision. Make a trapdoor incision. Extend your sternotomy into a infraclavicular or supraclavicular incision.
Right.
There's no limit to how many incisions you can make when you're trying to save somebody's life.
Excellent point. All right, so this that whole discussion really dovetails well into our next case. So this is less of a case, more of a concept. Here we're talking about resuscitative thoracotomy, and also kind of goes well with this. One of our previous episodes was about REBOA, all things REBOA, which also is very closely related to what we're doing here with the resuscitative thoracotomy. So, first question for Dr. Cotton, right? We're gonna divvy up. Either you have a blunt injured patient or patient with penetrating injury. Who is a candidate for resuscitative thoracotomy?
Let me start with the perfect candidate, and then we can go down. The perfect candidate, the one that you really want to be doing a resuscitative thoracotomy on, is a stab wound to the box with tamponade. That's the perfect one. That's the one, and I say the perfect one. When I say that, I mean that's the one that you're going to get your biggest bang for your buck from. That's the one that's going to have the highest, and I'll use this over and over, walk out of hospital survival. I'm not talking about physically getting physiology back and or a heartbeat and even cardiac function back in a young, healthy patient. But I'm talking about a walk out of survival, neurologically intact, return to function status is going to be your stab wound to the box. So that's your perfect candidate. Penetrating injury in general versus blunt, more penetrating than blunt as far as a likelihood of having any benefit to that patient.
I'm gonna jump in really quick.
Please.
And I'm gonna read from the EAST Practice Management Guidelines, okay, it was 2015, systematic review included 70 studies, okay, for penetrating, this regarding the outcomes. So penetrating injury following resuscitative thoracotomy, survival was 11% per that review. Again, and these data are highly skewed. With 90% neuro intact, blunt a 2% survival, 60% neuro intact. These are probably even maybe higher than than what we actually see in real life. But I want to jump in and say that's what the data says. That's probably the best numbers that you can kind of put in your mind and how dismal these outcomes
are. Right. And, yeah. So I did a Grand Rounds presentation on this years ago, and the most impressive was looking just at almost what you just summarized with penetrating stab wound to the box. So pericardial tamponade from a stab presenting with signs of life or arresting on arrival, those patients have got a 50% walk out of hospital survival rate based on the data at the time. So that's the one you really want to arrive to you. Those who lose vitals between 5 and 10 minutes prior to arrival would be the next one that are penetrating. Those who arrive within 10 to 15 with an established airway. And again, this goes back to just looking at the data, kind of really dissecting and subgrouping people. So they've gotten oxygenation. They've hopefully been neurologically maintained with closed chest CPR, and they've been intubated and oxygenating well on the way in, not just scoop and run, although I am a scoop and run proponent. So that would be your next level. And then finally, your blunt arrest pre-hospital with minutes out of hospital. Blunt with signs of life on arrival that you lose them or that arrive with vitals and they arrest in the ER would be the prime blunt candidate to be doing this on. And again, the other caveat to think about is anatomic. Outside of the box, or even at least outside of the cardiac and thoracic cavities, your likelihood of saving their life with a clamp or a BOA is really, really low. When they are exsanguinating outside of those areas and they have lost vitals and you are opening the chest or electing to do a BOA and closed chest, it's incredibly remote regardless of whether that's blunt or penetrating.
Yeah, and one of the things you first taught me when I arrived was, I remember one of my first shifts, a blunt MVC blunt patient came in with CPR for, I don't remember how long, a while, 20 minutes, 15 minutes. Actually, no, it was, I think, like 10 or 15 minutes. So something where it was like this wasn't an obscenely long amount of time. And you told me your approach to these blunt patients. And again, this patient had a negative fast and a clear chest X-ray.
Sure. So my blunt workup, I mean, it's penetrating as well. But my blunt workup, patient coming in without signs of life, or with signs of life but with no pulse. They're bringing CPR, closed chest CPR in. I start with ABCs, and it's an intervention at every level. If they've got an airway in or an eye gel or whatever, I ask them to either replace it or put one in, and most importantly, to take out the reasons that people are dying. So the reasons that people are dying that are retrievable are hypoxia and hypovolemia. So I want to make sure that their pre-hospital airway that was placed is actually an airway and not an esophageal airway. Next, I want to listen for breast sounds. I want to decompress any potential tension pneumothorax that's killing them. So they're going to get finger thoracostomies rapidly. And then C, they're going to get volume in the form of a colloid, either whole blood or red cells and plasma. And they're going to get it rapidly. And they are going to get a pericardial fast. This is one of the few times when patients arrive like this that I would actually bump finishing my primary before I brought in some radiographic evaluation. So a fast would be done at this point in time. And then D, looking at their pupils real quick, because those pupils are going to tell me a lot. People go, oh, they got sucks or they got rock in the field. That should not affect your pupillary muscles.
Important point.
It should not affect your pupillary muscles. Now, if they get, you know, atropine or something like that in the field, sure, there can be some impacts. But if they were getting just paralytics in the field to intubate them, their pupils should still be reactive. And if they are fixed and dilated, that is a huge break for me about proceeding, penetrating or blunt, but definitely in blunt. So that's my blunt workup. Check their airway. If they have one, make sure it's still through the cords and not in the esophagus. Check their breast sounds. Finger decompress them rapidly. Just assume they have tension pneumo. Put that pericardial fast up there for two reasons. One, see if they got a tamponade. And two, see if they have any cardiac activity. And then finally, D, look at their pupils. See if they're reactive pupils.
All right, Dr. Taub, so I pose a question to you. Blunt trauma, so MVC, young person, healthy. They have had, I'm going to give you different times of CPR and put you in the hot seat to see. And there's no right answer, but you know, kind of get to what you're thinking about whether or not you do resuscitate thoracotomy. So, young patient, I'll give you a workup first. They come in, they have a endotracheal tube that's in the right position, confirmed with CO2 capnography, something like that. It's confirmed. The X-ray looks good. No tension physiology in the chest, heart, or lungs. Finger decompressed. Let's say they have a positive abdominal fast. Okay, they come in with 5 minutes of CPR. That's your workup. Do you do resuscitate thoracotomy? They lose pulses and, or sorry, it's 5 minutes. Excuse me, 5 minutes of CPR. They've already lost pulses. Do you do resuscitate thoracotomy?
If the patient comes to me in pre-hospital arrest and blunt trauma,
yeah,
I am not going to do a resuscitative thoracotomy in that patient. Okay. Especially, this is for all blunt, but especially intra-abdominal hemorrhage. Intra-abdominal hemorrhage leading to traumatic arrest in a blunt trauma and in penetrating trauma. That's your chances of getting that patient back with any meaningful recovery is almost nothing. I know you quoted some big numbers there for survival,
right,
in penetrating 11% and 2% in blunt. Those are fivefold higher than the numbers I learned as a resident. So I think there's probably some selection bias going on in the numbers you quoted.
All right, let's say they have a not a negative fast. Okay, they have no cardiac activity on the, when you put a probe on, but they've been getting CPR for 5 minutes. Nothing in the chest.
Pre-hospital blunt arrest, I am not doing a thoracotomy.
Okay. Dr. Cotton, you want to add anything else to that?
Pre-hospital blunt arrest that doesn't respond to the above measures we talked about, resecuring that airway, decompressing both chests, and getting some volume in them, is unlikely to receive anything. Blunt is pretty much going to have life flight tell me that they arrested in the elevator or arrest in front of me. That is something, and again, if you don't get a bunch of blood out as soon as you put your finger in for that finger thoracostomy or get a rush of air, now you're saying it's probably head, and then head. Or let's say it's a horrible, horrible abdominal injury. You're now extra thoracic, and your likelihood of even penetrating salvageability is incredibly low, and then adding to that, neurologically salvageable. But I would add, just a plug for blunt, emergency department thoracotomy, the one that's going to need it is the one that's crashing in front of you, not already crashed.
Right.
So those are the ones, when we talk about survival rates that are, I think you claim, or you, not claim, sorry, that you stated were 2% for the blunts.
Yeah.
I suspect those were ones that had some physiology, were maybe 40s, 50s systolic. I absolutely think that's a patient that's going to get open. But one that has already lost pulses and is not a systolic, a measurable systolic, not a palpable carotid, none of that, that's a different, I think that's a, those are two different animals.
Perfect. So before we wrap up this, I just want to read what the exact recommendations are per Western Trauma Association and EAST, just for our listeners to have that as a background to our discussion. So Western Trauma Association, they say if you have less than, they're very broad, less than 15 minutes of CPR for penetrating injury. That's what's recommended from that. Blunt, less than 10 minutes of CPR, and you evaluate cardiac activity immediately. Those that are asystolic, when you're looking physically at the heart, you're done, okay? They are, all resuscitative efforts should be halted at that point. You don't keep going from there. You've done your evaluation. Per EAST, for penetrating, conditionally recommended for pulseless with or without signs of life. And those signs of life specifically are pupillary response, spontaneous ventilation, presence of a carotid pulse, measurable or palpable blood pressure, certainly extremity movement or cardiac electrical activity. It's also a fairly broad definition too. And then for blunt, again, recommendations for resuscitative thoracotomy, they say conditionally recommended for pulseless with signs of life, but not without signs of life. Okay, so again, it's very nuanced. And I think we had an excellent discussion leading up to that that kind of hits on it. It's a complicated situation.
That's why I think the signs of life thing is important. Do they have signs of life? And what we're talking about when we're talking about that is, do they have reactive pupils? Do they have at least some gasping respirations? Do they have any twitch movement in their extremities? Is there something there that even in the absence of a pulse shows that they are a fresh crash, that they are fresh arrest versus an arrest that's been down and is less likely to be salvaged. Because when you really break down the data that's out there on this topic, when they have signs of life, they are more salvageable than not. Sure. When they have vitals, they are more salvageable than signs of life. So there's different layers of it, and I think those are important. I also think it's important to figure out what incision that you're going to make when you do this. And my practice has evolved over time.
Yeah, I want maybe Dr. Talk could tell us tips, tricks to that recessive thoracotomy incision. What do you need to think about? What are some things you've learned over time about how to effectively do it?
So my training and my choice of incision has also evolved as I've learned from Dr. Cotton. But a lot my initial approach is a standard left anterolateral thoracotomy from the sternum just under the nipple and angling that incision up. Don't forget to go up towards the axilla. So you're not, if you go straight down, you'll be going between multiple rib spaces, and that's going to make things a lot more difficult for you. So that's my standard left anterolateral thoracotomy incision. I will often concomitantly place a right-sided chest tube. And if that right-sided chest tube has no output, then I'm done, and my left-sided anterolateral thoracotomy is my incision of choice. If I have any output from that right-sided chest tube, I will then extend to a bilateral thoracotomy with transverse sternotomy, also known as a clamshell. And then there are proponents and certainly advantages of a primary bilateral thoracotomy, doing a primary clamshell for ER traumatic arrest. But not everyone does that. I know that Dr. Cotton, that's his incision of choice. It saves you some time from evaluating that right chest. And also, you heard us talk about chest x-rays in some of these patients. We have a great luxury here of having chest x-ray machines bolted to the wall in the resuscitation bays. So there's no delay in getting digital chest x-rays. They happen in real time. Contra that to many hospitals where that chest x-ray is a portable machine rolling in. If the tech's not at lunch, she's there with your patient or he, and you get eventually an x-ray after the film gets taken back to the developing machine, and then 10 minutes later you have a chest x-ray. So if that's the case, there's no time for chest x-ray. Here we do have that luxury of getting chest x-rays even in some of our traumatic arrest patients.
I want to expand a little bit on what you said about technique. So again, for all our listeners, different levels, etc., we're going to start essentially just right at the edge of the sternum, almost a little on the sternum. You don't want to short yourself medially, okay? Nice bold strokes down right under the nipple, or the, again, Dr. Cotton used to describe the essentially bra line or the bra wire or whatever it may be.
Inframammary
fold. There's a word for that. A medical terminology, that would be correct. So you're along those lines, and then you direct your incision up. Your incision's not straight down to the bed, right? Your incision follows the rib, and it should be all the way down to the bed. You should be able to not move your hand any farther down onto the bed.
One of my professors during my fellowship, Vince Gracias, used to say, "Cut the bed."
Yeah,
and said we can always patch it up later. Now I say that flippantly, and I say that to reiterate Patrick's commentary, you don't want to cut the bed. Those are expensive items. However, it needs to go that far back. You need to do it like you were almost going to cut the bed.
Yeah. And then a couple, two, three strokes, it should be down on the chest wall into the muscle. Ideally, at least personally, I like to put a pair of big scissors in there and stay on the on top of the rib and follow that down as a means of opening. I avoid the knife and making more injuries iatrogenically.
Yeah. You can. What I can't remember the mechanical name, appropriate mechanical name of it, but opening the scissors, those large heavy mets, and following the crotch of it with the scissors slightly opened and sliding them up and down that superior aspect.
Almost
of that
like
rib.
A plastic wrap package.
Yeah.
You just kind of zip through.
Yeah.
You can do that with yes, exactly. When you're standing on top of the rib, avoiding the intercostal bundle, you get the rib spreader in place. Make sure you allow yourself access to. Complete a clamshell, complete a sternotomy. So you have to arrange that a rib spreader so that you're not blocking, you're locking yourself in. When that happens, the crank and the track, I guess, that you crank on is going to be on the patient's skin and on the bed, and it will almost inevitably get caught on clothing or skin, and it will stop, slow your progress. So make sure you don't have anything in the way as you're cranking the ribs open. You want to check, you need good access, when you get in, you want to be able, say for a cross-clamping aorta, you need to take that inferior pulmonary ligament down. Ideally, if you have a partner in crime with you there, they can grab the lung, forcefully pull it up and out of your way so that you can get into that, through that peritoneum, get your hand around, if not, you know, mostly around the aorta to make sure you're appropriately cross-clamped.
If you're going to cross-clamp the aorta, the only way to do this is to make a tunnel above and below, anterior and posterior to the aorta in the pleura. Otherwise, you cannot get that clamp on. You'll think you have that clamp on, mm-hmm. and the next time you look, that clamp is just going to be sitting in the middle of the chest. So make sure you get your hand, sweep your hand down along the rib cage up to the thoracic spine, and just anterior to that's going to be the aorta encased in some pretty thick connective tissue and pleura that you have to go through. It's helpful if you can have your colleagues at the head of the bed place an NG or OG tube. Absolutely. So you can feel that NG tube, which is in the esophagus, and you'll know because a flat aorta feels a lot like an esophagus.
Very good.
And these patients should all have flat aortas because they should all be in hemorrhagic
shock. And how do you get into the pericardial sac? You know, heart's beating at you, or maybe, who knows if it's not. Let's say it's beating at you, or maybe not. But it can be hard to grab. It can be tense. What's your approach?
I try to grab it with a couple of toothy pickups and use a Metz to incise the pericardium.
Right, and you incise longitudinally, staying away from the phrenic nerve. Anything, Dr. Cotton, any way you grab it?
Yeah, so hopefully if you're doing it for the number one reason to be doing this, which is a tamponade, you're not going to be able to grasp it. So at that point, I will have a knife in my hand and use a 15 or a 10 blade and just nick the pericardium because, again, it's going to be too tense to grab, and then finish it off with Metz, again, open like we talked about, up and down along that phrenic, just parallel to it all the way up. And take it up. Don't be afraid to take it up high because it can go up to that root. You're going to be able to deliver the heart out a lot easier. So let's take a step back for a second. Yeah. So you open the chest. Hopefully you're going to find some blood there that's going to be, it's going to be a thoracic or cardiac injury. So I open the chest. I've got my clamp, like you just talked about. I've got the finichetto aimed up to the axilla with the U part of it aimed up to the axilla. Really get that left arm cranked up behind them, almost like they're sitting on it with their hand behind their head, because you will frequently grab the axillary fat and or skin and really trash that. And just, you know, just from a style point, it really kind of looks kind of trashy if you rip up all that skin up there. So now I'm in the chest. Now my first thing is grossly addressing any hemorrhage. Is anything actively bleeding up my face? If anything is, that could be a subclavian like we talked about earlier. That could be a PA. I'm going to be putting packs to whatever area, or if it's a PA, hopefully getting my fingers around it before I can get a Satinsky or something else that you want to put down there. Next step is going to be to take down that ligament, the inferior pulmonary ligament, so that any movement of that lung does not tear any of the vasculature. Then I'm going to be looking at the heart and getting a cross clamp on, you know, incising the pleura, getting the cross clamp on, and then addressing the heart. Opening up the heart, almost all these, I open up the pericardium to start my cardiac compressions or explore the heart, and then address that at that time. You've got to have that cross clamp. In fact, if it's not done almost simultaneously, it ought to be done, in my opinion, probably first, because any cardiac compressions are going to be worthless to the heart and the brain unless you have that thing cross-clamped. And again, simultaneously with blood volume.
I think that covers the left side. And I want to mention it's important to incise and open that pericardium every time you do a resuscitative thoracotomy, even though it may not look like there's a tamponade. Sometimes there's a tamponade and you just can't see it through some of the thicker pericardium. So it's absolutely important to open it and deliver the heart. And if you're doing this for a pulseless patient, which that's what we're talking about here, you need to deliver the heart anyway to perform open cardiac massage.
I should ask you a quick question too. This is, and that was a Dr. Cotton's description was better. The systematic approach is a better way to discuss this, the technique to resuscitate thoracotomy. What about jamming stuff into the heart for resuscitation for access, and or jamming, you know, an epistick directly to the heart? I've seen people do this or talk about it.
So let's address the last one first. Episticks are for Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. That's right.
Episticks are for Pulp Fiction and for Quentin Tarantino movies. I would not do that to this patient. If you need to do something like that for a patient, you're simply going to get them back, even if you do briefly, and they're just going to coat again.
Yeah, if you give an epistick to a T-bone steak, it's going to beat too.
But as far as access, if you have no other access,
yeah, you can't
I will
get any
absolutely
other
access. Do a right atrial appendage line.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Put a purse string. Usually you're going to have some silk suture available to you in the emergency room. Quick purse string, incise it with whatever knife you have or a scissor in between your purse string. And I use an IV tubing without any attachments because of that lure lock end is nice and bulbous. It'll catch on your purse string, stick into the right atrium, and then that is, of course, hooked up to a massive rapid infuser. Here we use Belmont, but that may be level one infuser in your institution.
Yeah, so I would do a similar approach. I usually get a side-biting Sutensky on that atrial appendage, and then do my purse string, and then literally cut the appendage to accommodate it. Over the years, I'll tell you that I've gone from doing the straight IV tubing like Dr. Todd discussed. I will still do that occasionally, but because it's so larger, it's perfect to get in, and or when it's once it's in, it sticks larger. It's almost like the peg mushroom, if you will, to hold it in place. And so it's great once it's in, but it's a pain in the ass to get in sometimes if you haven't made that hole large enough. And so I will tell you occasionally what I like to use more is a RIC line, a resuscitation catheter. And it's so it looks like a small, and we have these in our trauma bay. If you don't have them, you should get them. It looks like a small cordis, a short cordis. And with that, I can make a small incision, go straight in with the introducer and cordis off this RIC, get it in place, remove the dilator introducer, and now I have a small cordis in the right atrium, which also has that little side eye spot that I can secure into place so it's not moving back and forth in addition to a possible purse string. That's just another maneuver to consider when doing this. And then finally, I think the discussion would be whether or not to do clamshell or just a left anterolateral.
Yeah, perfect. All right, and to finish off this discussion too, Dr. Kahn has an article that influenced his thinking on approach to these to resuscitative thoracotomies.
Yeah, so when I was in my first fellowship and then into my first job, I was left anterolateral thoracotomy, cut the bed. Left anterolateral thoracotomy, cut the bed. And there were a couple of body habitus, especially when I went from Philadelphia to Nashville, the body habitus changed, and some of that left anterolateral thoracotomy could sometimes be a little more challenging to access all the things that we just talked about doing, especially if it was trying to get a right atrial appendage line in. And I started thinking more along the lines of doing clamshells for everyone. And I will tell you, if someone crashes in the operating theater with the lights, with all the equipment, with all that amazing help that we have up there, I'm probably more likely still to do a left anterolateral thoracotomy. But if someone dies, if they die in the emergency department or right before they get to us, that patient in my practice now will get a clamshell. And even though my practice was kind of heading that way, there was an article by Sims, Eric Sims, S-I-M-M-S, that came out in 2013. I can't remember if it was World Journal of Surgery or another journal, but it came out and it showed an anatomic cadaver study where they looked at all the different approaches and they gave it green spots if you got great view, yellow if it was an iffy view, and red if you had no view. And the clamshell or bilateral anterolateral thoracotomies gave the best view of almost anything you needed to repair in a patient that have lost pulses in the emergency department. And so, yes, it's a much more morbid decision, and I think that's why Dr. Todd still, most people, he can do that left anterior thoracotomy on, and I agree. That was my practice for years. I've shifted over that if, oh my God, if they're dead, they're going to get a dead man's incision, and that's going to be a clamshell. And I think you can access more. I'm not saying I get better outcomes or better survival, but I feel like
you get
I
to have, see. You see more, though.
I get to see, and I know that I've looked at everything possible by doing that. That's just my bias. Perfect.
And one more thing to mention when you're doing this, if you get the patient back, don't forget about your mammaries. The mammary arteries are going to bleed. Yep.
And if you get them back, they are bleeding. Yeah. Or so, if your CPR is effective, you're going to see it.
So put some hemostats on those mammaries while you extricate the patient to the operating room.
Yeah. And one last thing, if you're doing, you know, also learn how to do appropriate open cardiac massage. It's a two-handed technique. It is not one hand and a thumb. It is a two-handed technique.
What happens when you put that thumb on the anterior heart?
Well, depending on their cardiac muscle, you can go right through it.
Exactly.
Exactly. All right, great.
All right, that wraps it up for today. Lots of great discussion. I'm, again, thrilled Dr. Taub and Dr. Cotton were able to join us today. That comprises part one of our complex case series. Please tune in next time for part two. We're going to go over some more pretty fantastic cases and get some more insight from experts in the field. Until then, dominate the day. Until next time, dominate the day.